You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
Yes, please do.
What's the longest you've ever gone without working out?
How old am I?
You are 32, I believe. 32 years old.
So, a couple months, probably.
Great.
It's one of those things that I never integrated into my lifestyle. I was not very athletic growing up, as anybody can attest. There's video records. Emma loves watching the videos of me trying to play soccer when I was like six, because I would stand in the soccer goal and the game would be going on, right? There, you know, lots of kids running around trying to score whatever, and I'd be practicing my karate moves. Good stance, throwing punches, throwing kicks, and then the ball would just come by into the goal. There's one video of the kid on my team, or kid on the other team, whoever, who like came up and like pushed me like, play. Like, please play. And I refuse to.
I mean, that's better than me. You know what I did on the soccer team?
What did you do?
I mean, I threw the ball at the kids' heads.
Did you? Were you the violent kid?
Yeah.
Were you the angry, violent kid?
Yeah, it's because it was their old white.
Oh, were you like the, were, did you feel out of place?
It's because they were white.
And as I sat there wondering, what could he mean with his racially charged comments? It occurred to me. Cue the theme song.
Little justice. There's something in there.
That back to the racial stuff. I can do something with that.
It's back. No, but ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Little Justice. That story, by the way, is true. I was kicked off my soccer team. Because I did throw the ball at kids. I got angry. I had a lot of anger issues that I took out on the soccer team, on the basketball team. I also didn't...
You can't touch the soccer ball with your hands.
I know.
Unless you're the goalie. I remember this. So did you picked it up and you chucked it at someone's
head? I would just get frustrated. I would just get really mad. Like, and I couldn't play. Like, I also wasn't good at sports. So like, you know, and sports is a learned skill. I did not want to put my time into that learned skill. You know, that said... As the years went on, you know, I tried my hand at working out. I do work out pretty regularly now. I feel like it's hard because I feel like I have some sort of body dysmorphia. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, here's the thing. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you're probably a lot better looking than you give yourself credit for.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the images that we see, you know, on a daily basis and, you know, the fact that we're all slaves to those images, you know, oftentimes we find ourselves crapping on ourselves unnecessarily. And that is most of my life. For instance, the last time I worked out was Saturday. I'm mad at myself that, you know, I haven't worked out since Saturday, but it's been a super busy week. It's been, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Where we are today, it's super busy. And I was going to work out today, but...
Yeah, you've been exercising your work ethic.
My work ethic and my scheduling powers.
So you just need to work on changing your perspective, I think.
I do. No. That's absolutely... I'm the kind of guy who gives himself shit about having a nightcap. If you know what I mean? Like, if I haven't worked out, I'm like, oh, I can't do that. It's like, you know what? Just have the nightcap. But I don't want to do that. I feel like that's too much. That's going overboard. Meanwhile, I'm also pouring ounces of syrup into my oatmeal. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's all very fucked up. None of it makes sense.
You eat oatmeal and you tell me about how you're eating oatmeal as a way of like, I'm eating oatmeal. Like, this is healthy. I'm being good. But you're pouring ounces of syrup into it at the same time.
Yeah.
This is like the story. I'm just going to blow up your spot right now. This is about this, like the story you told me yesterday.
Yeah.
So I posted a picture of you. We have a live cast tonight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're going to talk about that on the live cast too. Continue.
We'll talk about it. But so I had to make a poster image. So I looked for the most embarrassing photo of you I could find. And there's a brief phase in your life somewhere between senior
year of college.
20 and 21. Yeah, somewhere in there where you just kind of ballooned a little bit. You became a little chub monster.
A little bit.
And I was like, ah, that's pretty funny. The reason that you gave me for that is that you had begun to adopt that you needed to exercise, but didn't know how. So you just started drinking muscle milk.
Accurate. I just started
without the exercise to go along with it. So you're just drinking this like pure protein.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
It's ridiculous. I mean, and again, I'm the kind of person, I don't like to ask. Like, I hate to ask. I like to know. Like, so I'm just gonna assume that if I hear something, I'm not gonna vet it for myself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that was definitely that phase where I did not vet it for myself and thusly just added on some pounds. But, you know, I survived. Here we are. We're back. And we got a really good theme today. I'm really excited about this theme.
Yeah. Well, so every now and then, we're a movie podcast.
We are a movie podcast. Foremost,
but
yeah.
You come from theater. We're on the Broadway Podcast Network. So every now and then we do dip into this territory.
We do.
And I think that it gives you a moment to shine because I'm smarter than you. I'm more well versed than you.
Yeah.
I make
Keep
more
going
poignant
with that.
Points than you. Better looking. List goes on and on. But when we hit theater, I'm a little out in the cold here.
Ooh.
So yeah, set it up. I'm riding in your wake on this one.
I love that. I love that you're riding my wake. I think that that's a great wake to ride in. So we wanted to do stage to screen adaptations, and we realized that that's kind of not necessarily a one part episode. So because you have plays that have been adapted into movies, and then you also have musicals. And the movie musical is its own thing in itself. And I think the best way to phrase this, I'm going to say rather than the best, because we rarely do the best on here. I definitely want to say our favorites, mm-hmm. Movie musicals, or our favorite stage to screen adaptations. Part one, we will deal with the musical. Part two, we will deal with the play. And I think that that is the way to go. But it really is an interesting thing when you are, especially when you're adapting a musical, because musicals, I was just having this conversation with a buddy of mine who I wish could have been on this as a guest on this episode, and we'll have to bring him back. We'll have to do like a part two of movie musicals and bring him back, because he is a genius at this in his own right. His name is Aaron Albano, and he is just one of the sweetest people I know, also somebody with Broadway credits up my arm. He is been in the game for years and years and years, currently plays Samuel Seabury in Hamilton on tour. And but Aaron is a kind of an aficionado of a lot of movie musicals. And, you know, we were talking about this today, like it really, musicals truly are a craft unto themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I have for a long time, I'll admit, like not ignored the craft, but just not considered the craft of a musical. And you know, like, and even as someone who has written a musical, you know, is writing one right now, like they really are a specific genre, and you have to know the rules in order to break the rules. And you have to really kind of, you know, find your way in.
Well, let me ask you a question. So yeah. in your perspective, and obviously this is going to be different for everybody.
Yeah.
Is a musical, Because a musical carries its emotional weight in its music, right? Like the story is told through song, and sometimes like the lyrics don't even need to make sense for you to understand what's going on. Would you say that a stage musical is closer to its storytelling is closer to a play or closer to like an opera?
In terms of a movie musical, you mean? Or a
No, a stage musical.
A stage musical. It depends entirely on the musical. I think there are so many musicals that borrow heavily from opera and operetta. Like one of the things that I love, if you ever listen to South Pacific, which is low key one of my favorite musicals, so many musicals say, you know, you got to have an opening number. Well, South Pacific breaks that entirely. South Pacific songs, I think the brilliance of it is that they, you know, and it comes, I mean, South Pacific was based on a play, I believe, Tales of the South Pacific, but it comes from, I'm going to fact check that to make sure I'm not an idiot, because I could be an idiot right now, but I'm pretty sure it's Tales of the South Pacific. But the beauty of the opening of South Pacific is that it literally is a scene, and they wrote the scene first, and then out of that came the songs. Like the songs come very much plot driven. And that's honestly with a lot of Rodgers and Hammerstein, like the songs are incredibly plot driven, and they're not just numbers for numbers' sakes. They are
right.
Numbers that develop organically. And that is a very operatic thing, right? Opera, where the entire piece is sung through, where you have recit and you have, you know, song. An opera enthusiast could definitely tell you more about this than I could. But what I will say is that, you know, the songs are the story. And oftentimes, especially in modern musicals, and this is a trope that I hate, there is nothing that I hate more than this, when a song is in there because it's time for that song, rather than a song that develops naturally out of the mood and the scene and the need of the piece. You know, there's kind of this trope right now. There was this trope in the 90s when you had all these kind of pop chamber musicals like Ragtime and others like that, where like end of act one was your gospel number.
Right.
Every end of act one was your gospel number. And that was like the big thing. And it's like, I mean, if it works, sure. But also why do you need that? Like, why is that the thing? Or like, you know, if you have an actor in your show or an actress in your show who is kind of a name, but they're in a featured role, give them a number at the top of act two.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, why?
I mean, I think in the last few decades, art across the board has broken away from needing as much of a framework in its creation. You know, back, if you look at like classical music, for instance, right? Classical music was developed and enjoyed and criticized based on what classical music should be, right? There's rules to an aria, there's rules to a canon. You know, the music should be doing something within a very specific framework, even to like blues, things where like you follow a certain set of rules for it. And I'm sure opera and musicals, like if you dug into it, like especially back in the day, like, yeah, like that's just what you did because that's what the form called for. And I think over time people have felt a little braver in branching out and, you know, trying to find some new ground. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
And to your point, to be fair, I think one of the things that I, you know, I'm just remembering, and by the way, Tales from the South Pacific is a book. It was adapted from a book. Not a play, but,
I was in South Pacific in high school.
Were you? Who'd you play?
I did like a random sailor.
I love that. I was in South Pacific in elementary school. You know?
You beat me. I was in Little Mermaid in elementary school.
Of course you were.
I played a sailor again. I don't know what it was.
Listen,
I think a good sailor.
People look at you and they say, you belong on a boat far out, far away from people. No, but I think that, you know, if you trace back the musical to its cabaret, to its variety show roots, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Then yeah, of course you have songs in there that are just to showcase the performer. I personally don't if I'm seeing a musical and it's not story driven, I'm already out. I'm like, I don't care about this. Because there's ways to do it where it can still be a variety show esque, but also give you story. And I think that that is the challenge, but I think that that is a good challenge, you know, so it really does come down to, you know, your preference and what you love, but all this to say, the movie musical is a hard bat to swing.
So we're not just talking about movie musical. We're talking about a movie musical based on a stage musical, right? Somebody
yes,
who's
absolutely.
taken the story from the stage and transplanted it onto film.
Which is a harder bat to swing. And
you think
so,
it's a harder bat to swing?
I do. I think that if you have a musical that you are a movie that you are writing as a musical, then that form does not have to be adapted. You're taking something that was one thing.
Right.
And you're taking something that it did not exist before and you are putting it into this form. So you can follow the rules of moviedom.
Right.
With a stage musical, you have to account for the fact that at the basic level, stage is auditory. We hear before we see. So the stage version is written to be heard, right? It is written to be heard first. Movies are written to be seen. And thusly, you know, with a stage musical, like for instance, I kind of gave you a little red herring here because I texted Alex last night and I told him, you're going to hate me for what I'm watching. And I was going to choose this until you guessed what it was, and I said, nope, actually, I'm not going to go with this one.
Oh.
I
thought maybe I shouldn't say. I was like, well, no one has to know that I...
Yeah, I was going to do it just to piss you off. It was going to be Cats. I had never seen Cats, and I wanted to watch Cats, and I was like, ooh, let me just see. And here's the thing. Like, Andy Blankenbuehler, who is probably one of the best choreographers of our time, choreographed this movie. You know, he is also the choreographer of Hamilton. I'm a huge, huge fan of his work. And I will say I'm sending him an email today. Like, his work in this movie is incredible. I really do. And as someone who doesn't know dance, I'm sure that there are people who are, you know, very much in the Cats world who,
yeah,
you know, are looking at this movement and being like, well, that's not what we did on stage. What I will say for the story that I saw being told or being attempted to be told, I loved what he did movement wise. I thought it was just very inventive and fun.
Because I don't know how it works. Is Cats, I assume Lion King is another show that's like this, is because it's such an institution, does the blocking ever really change? Or when you go see Cats on stage, is it the almost the exact same Cats that you would
so
have seen 5 years ago?
There was the original Cats that was in the West End, and then and that Judi Dench was actually going to be in until she tore her Achilles.
Classic Dame.
Classic Dame Judi. And then she bounces from that, and Elaine Page comes in. I think she was supposed to play Grisabella, and Elaine, who sings Memory, and then Elaine Page comes in and takes the world by storm. And then it transferred to Broadway, and that choreography was set. And that was once it was on Broadway, that was the choreography that you saw for the next 10, 15 years. Then with the revival that happened 3 or 4 years ago, Andy came in, and it was kind of half the original choreo and then half Andy's stuff. And Andy's stuff, if you've ever seen Hamilton or if you've ever seen In the Heights, it's very, like, again, I'm not a dancer, but I can only describe what I feel when I watch it. It's very it's like watching somebody's brain on fire. Like, it's very jerky is like such a crude way of describing it, but he definitely steals from hip hop a lot. Like, he's definitely in a great way. He's definitely like, yeah, a lot of, like, you know, very like jerky into a smooth movement that like makes you feel it actually, to me, worked really well on supposedly feline bodies. I was like, oh yeah, that's fun, you know. And this movie, I think, was completely Andy, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong. It was interesting to watch because I'm not even gonna say whether it was good or bad. What I will say is, like, it just showed me, yeah, translating that musical onto screen is the most ridiculous job you could ever have, because the musical itself is so abstract. And within the first 10 minutes of it, I was like, oh, this should have been animated. Not to knock on anything that was done, but it was just like, this would be so, like, and not even like a CGI Pixar animation. I'm talking like old school Fantasia. Like,
right.
Because it's just so fantastical.
And they went the opposite direction.
They went the exact opposite. It was like that Tom Hooper thing where he tries to make it real. And it's like, this is not real. Like, this is it. And it shouldn't be. Like, that's the thing. When you see it in a stage, you're like, you kind of buy the conceit because it's so theatrical.
Right.
That you're able to be like, yeah, these are not cats. Like, we're not trying to believe that these are cats. These are human beings,
right,
doing amazing movement.
Well, so speaking of Tom Hooper and musicals, the other thing that I thought maybe you would choose, and I guess you didn't because I also addressed it, was Les Mis.
Yeah.
The Les Mis movie with Russell Crowe and Hugh Jackman, which, a bit of Little Justice trivia here, the very first time we ever tried to do this show back way back.
Oh, God.
In the day,
I hope nobody ever hears it.
We were like, oh, we'll review movies as they come out and whatever. First one we did was Les Mis. I think we found a copy online somewhere and it had stayed up, and we got rid of it quickly because it's so.
Yeah,
it was negative. But same director doing a movie musical that's meant to be people. And so bringing. And it's historical and it's kind of moody. And so bringing that to film, do you think that worked? I mean, it did. It was it was kind of a terrible film, but it still worked better, I think, than Cats probably.
It worked better. But I think the thing, you know, thinking back to that movie, and granted, I haven't seen this movie in years, but thinking back to that movie, I think the thing that like really just took me out of it was like, it was almost like he couldn't decide. There were stylized sets and there was realistic sets. And it was very much the same with Cats. It was like, decide what your world is. I'm very confused on what your world is. And that's taking me out of it. And also, here's the other thing I want to say about Tom Hooper specifically. The pre-record in a musical, okay, when the idea of, you know, the actors singing live on set versus the pre-record. Here's what I want to say about that. I am a trained singer. I've been singing for 10 plus years professionally, getting paid to do it. Singing is hard. Singing is really hard for those of us who sing 8 shows a week, let alone people who can sing really well, but are singing while running around, doing sword fights, doing all this. It takes a lot of stamina. And it is really unfair to put actors in a situation. Like, I watch Russell Crowe in Les Mis, And here's the thing. I still think Russell Crowe is an amazing actor. I think he has like a Humphrey Bogart, like pulled in, like just gruffness that works on camera, and that he is just so wonderful. And he can sing. He was in a band for 12 years. But when you're putting him in a situation where you're having him sing music that is like not easy music to sing.
Yeah.
And you're having him do it amidst all the moving parts of a film set. That's very hard.
Well, so do you think it was a mistake for Tom Hooper? Because they recorded that music on set, right? And usually they record it in a sound booth with the actors, and then you kind of pantomime it. But for Les Mis, if I remember correctly, they wanted to record them singing in person. Do you think that was a failed experiment with Russell Crowe? Like, would it have been different?
I don't think it was a failed experiment. I think that the lesson learned is if you have a Hugh Jackman who has the muscles to do that, absolutely. Go for it. Boom.
Yeah.
You're in. But there is nothing wrong with a pre-record. There's in fact, a pre-record frees up the actor because then they're not worried about the tech. Like watching him, I was like, it just seemed like he went to so many vocal coaches and they all gave him so many different things. And it's like, dude, at the end of the day, what we're missing is your performance. And that's what we want to see. And so I'm like, yeah, I just don't think you should hold any actor to that. I think it's like, if an actor feels more comfortable recording in the booth, let him record in the booth. If they feel more comfortable singing on set, let them sing on set. Do you know what I mean? But like, understand that it's a very individual thing. And especially for a movie musical, you need to meet these actors where they're at.
Yeah.
And that speaks to another part of it, which is like with a stage to screen adaptation of a musical, there are elements to which you really have to think about, just like the fact that it's not like, you know, Lindsay Ellis, who does a bunch of amazing kind of analysis videos, did a great video on movie musicals, I believe. And she talked about when Susan Stroman adapted The Producers, and Susan Stroman basically just put a camera in front of her stage play and filmed it. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, I love that movie. It's like, I love the original movie. I love that movie. I think they're both hysterical, but there is a disservice done to the story because, yeah, it is just a staged musical.
Right. And you can tell pretty immediately that that's what's going on.
That that's what's happening, as opposed to something where you really think it through. And, you know, I think this wasn't the movie I chose, but I think the example that showed how to do this the best, and it's no denying it, was Rob Marshall's Chicago. That was the time when we saw, oh, actually we can do this. And it can be in all one succinct world, and we can make it like a true prestige picture and make sense. Mm-hmm. And be wonderful, but like justify the Broadway of it all. And
right.
And that it worked for that specific story, because that specific story was about disillusionment and, you know, believing your own hype and what fame does to your brain. And so you put the musical numbers inside her brain, and all of a sudden it's this really wonderfully artsy film about Chicago, which is like, if you've ever seen the show, Chicago's not that deep. Like, the movie is much deeper than the musical. He found a way to add on to the story. And that's what, when I was choosing my choice for the best musical movie or the best stage to screen adaptation musical, that was my thing, was like, what is a musical that I feel takes the baton from the stage version and runs with it?
So before we get into choices, just because I know our listeners are probably going to want to hear your opinion on it specifically, because you spent so much time with the show. It's technically a stage to screen thing, but it's screen on stage. What was your reaction to the Hamilton film?
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Have not watched it.
So you did this show twice a day for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it just because you couldn't handle it?
I'm not ready to watch it yet. Like, it's this really weird thing with Hamilton specifically, where it is still very, very close. Like, it's still like a very raw part
of the relationship or something.
Yeah. And it's like, I can't go back. And I know that sounds strange to say, but you have to understand how much I put into this freaking play. And I haven't seen that cast perform it in 5 years. And, you know, that was the cast that when I was coming in, I saw, you know, so I'm very excited to watch it at some point. It will not be during this quarantine. Did you watch it?
We didn't get all the way through, but not because we weren't enjoying it. I think it was, I'd seen it a couple times. Thanks to you, I was able to secure myself tickets.
Yeah, you know.
It didn't do anything new. right? I think it was a good opportunity for everybody to be able to see it, because obviously it's a very tightly guarded show in terms of, you know, if you can't see it in person, you can't see it. So I think to finally expose people to it, I think it was a little, the timing's a little unfortunate of its release, because I think that the messaging of it doesn't quite stand up to what we're going through right now in the country. Not that it doesn't address things, but I think that if it was written now, it would amplify certain things that as it stands, it just doesn't. So it felt a little bit incomplete.
That's been a conversation, you know. It's so, we actually talked about this with Lynn, like on the other, my other show that shall not be named on the show. But we talked about like, once you put a piece of art out there, especially like a movie or a stage play or musical, like that thing, it doesn't, you know, TV shows grow with the times, you know, these things are what they are and they speak to the moment that they're made in. And there is only so much you can do. That said, you know, I think it is interesting to watch it in these circumstances and be like, how does this incredibly Obama era piece stand up to what we're facing right now? You know, and I don't know.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So,
well, eventually you'll have to watch it and we'll have to
talk. We could have,
maybe we should do like a live, like we should watch it together and talk about it and just record.
I actually think that would be, let us know if you want us to do that. Tweet at us at Little Justice Pod. See that. I worked it in.
Yeah, that's pretty
worked
nice.
It in.
That's
Tweet
pretty
us nice. At Little Justice Pod, or special announcement, get at us on our new Instagram.
Yeah, thank you for finally setting that
Shut
one
up. Little Justice Pod, LiljusticePod Pod on Instagram. Come hit us up. Let us know if that's what we should do.
You want to hop in? I have an inkling.
Do you know what it is?
I'm trying to think. So I went to look because I'm not so versed in movie musicals. Yeah. I looked at lists, right? Sometimes when I can't figure it out, I go to like, well, what's the internet say? The top 10, whatever. And I realized like there's really not a huge selection pool.
Stage to screen adaptations,
Stage to screen of musicals. Once you include plays, it obviously broadens. But knowing our individual tastes,
oh, and you know exactly what mine is.
I think we might have landed on the same one, just because I'm trying to think what else it could be, unless you were going to go, you know, Cats or Les Mis or something
that.
So how do you want to start? Or
I mean, let me ask you this: does yours start on a rainy day?
It does.
Yep.
Well,
a rainy night in London.
In London,
and there's and we scroll down, we go down, not scroll down, but the camera pans down, you know, through, and we see the London rooftops, and we hear some really great music. We see these
it's like there's like a really intricate, weird, almost animated,
very it feels almost like an old Broadway set, like very much feels like a surreal, and then we cut in through a window that all of a sudden raindrops spatter on it and then blood spatters on it.
Like the fakest rain too. I'm watching this and realizing it's not too long ago, 2007. Is that what it was? The CG and almost intentionally.
Oh, very intentionally.
I think.
Very intentionally.
But the rain especially, I could have done that in After Effects.
Absolutely.
Like, it was very, very
absolutely
fake.
It was incredibly fake, but we pan in through this window, and there's a chair, leather chair, sitting there, We go down this chair, and then we go to, down a hole in the floor, and the title comes up. What is that title, Alex?
Sweeney Todd. Yes. I'm not gonna sing the song.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, baby. The Demon.
Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
But there's no place like London.
No, there's no place like London.
Mr. Todd?
You are young. Life has been kind to you. You will learn.
All I could think the whole time watching this movie is the time is the episode of The Office where Andy does the like
attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. Oh my god, I love it. I love it. Here's the thing. So many musical theater fans that I know did not like this movie. And they did not like this movie.
Really?
I'll tell you why. They did not like this movie for I think the biggest reason was the singing. And here's what I will give them. When you have grown up listening to Len Carreyrou or George Hearn and Angela Lansbury doing this on a recording.
A customer! What you rush, what you hurry? You gave me such a fright. I thought you was a ghost half a minute. Can't you sit you down, sit? All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks.
Who are, again, professionally trained singers, 8 shows a week singers, and yeah, they flesh out Sondheim's music and it sounds a certain way and you are used to that. Yeah, this is not that.
All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come in for a poison? Don't forgive me if me head's a little vague.
What was that?
But you think we had the play from the way that people keep avoiding.
No, I didn't. And also, you know, what you're cutting is you're cutting the townspeople. You know, there's some great songs like God That's Good, which kind of gets cut in half, which, you know, all the ensemble numbers are cut from this. All the ballad interludes are cut from this. There's a little, there's like some more stuff with the young lovers, the Joanna and Anthony. That's cut. Kiss Me is this amazing quartet between Anthony and Joanna and the judge and Beetle Bamford. Mm-hmm. That's cut. All that said, in terms of taking a stage production and making and taking the baton and running with it, there's truly, I don't think there's a better. Number one, it's my favorite Tim Burton movie of the past, I'd say 20 years now. I just think that his style. He both constrained his style for this movie and his style fit this movie.
Yes. I think as soon as you give Tim Burton CG, right? As soon as he transitions from Beetlejuice into the modern era kind of thing, you lose, you know, his charm was in taking these illustrative, almost cartoony images and building sets and costumes and warping.
He was the Ed Wood of his day.
Yeah, and that felt very genuine. As soon as you give him an unlimited palette in the form of CGI with Alice in Wonderland and all this stuff, it doesn't really fit. But I found in Sweeney Todd, maybe because it's coming from the stage and there is no expectation of realism or anything like that. Like it, the color and the costumes and the sets were all in that perfect,
they were fantastic.
It didn't go too far, but it wasn't too grounded. Nope. I was almost, and I have a, I bought a nice new TV last year, really nice, you know, and that gets down and like the blacks are just like black. It looks like the TV's off.
Yeah.
And this film, the dynamic contrast in this film that between the highlights and the shadows is unbelievable. Like it just looked beautiful. Emine was watching, I was on headphones and she was just looking at the screen. She looked at me at one point. She's like, this looks really good.
No, it's shot like a black and white film. I mean, he really does light this thing so expertly and you get there's just a sense of foreboding that I don't even know. I mean, honestly, as somebody who's seen it on stage multiple times, you know, there's the filmed Broadway version, and then I saw the revival with Michael Cerveris and Patti LuPone, which was great in its own right. There's some things that they did that I didn't necessarily agree with, but it was great. But the production that I saw that I think is the best production ever was most recently there was a production. Oh my god, I'm gonna forget the name of this theater, but it was a production that was down. I'm looking it up as we speak. It was, I mean, they built the theater into a pie shop. And so it was, it was like, I mean, it was literally the most intimate production that you've ever, been in Barrow Street Theater. The Barrow Street Theater, and they turned, so you stepped in, and like, first of all, the theater is tiny. So like, you are sitting in like a like literally maybe 200, 300 seat theater. And if you get the special seats, you come in like 30 minutes, 45 minutes early, and they serve you pies, like actual meat pies, and you're sitting like picnic style. And then the play starts and the actors are like on the tables, and like it was terrifying. It's all lit by candlelight.
Yeah, because to me, Sweeney Todd never really made sense without much history of theater. Like it there's blood and murder, and they're like eating people. Yeah. And like the content is very, very dark for a musical.
But the, I mean,
right, where they're singing these warm songs. It always felt like, how does this work? And watching it again made me realize, like, oh, like this.
And
is
that's how it works. We need to just talk about this, because you know, this goes back to the genius of one man, which is Stephen Sondheim. Stephen Sondheim, I think, you know, he's the best musical theater composer of all time. And he,
can you just highlight some of his highlights?
I mean, let's go through. So Sweeney Todd, Company, Merrily We Roll Along, Assassins, which is my other favorite of his, Sunday in the Park with George. The list goes on and on. Passions. His music. His music is very distinctive. He's able to blend styles, but it's very complex music. He's writing. He's very much kind of a precursor to Lin. Basically, what Lin does with rap and spoken word, Sondheim does with music, and it's very much. I think that what I've always loved about Sondheim's work is that his music sounds like the characters. It's very specific for each character. And every character has their own rhythm and their own melody and their own way of saying things. And he really does write dialogue as music.
I feel you, Joanna. I feel you. I was half convinced I'd waken, satisfied to dream you. Happily I was mistaken, Joanna.
What he knew, what he gets, and what I think even the 70s production kind of did a disservice to in a way, was that you build tension. It's the class, and we talk about this all the time. It's that Hitchcock thing. You put a bomb in the room, right? If you put a bomb in the room, if you know that a bomb's going to go off, then you can have, you know, in the actors, the characters don't know the bomb is going to go off, but the people watching know the bomb is going to go off. You can have the characters talk about anything you fucking want them to talk about, because the longer they talk, the more tense we're going to get. And that is why the music in Sweeney Todd is so warm, because so often you are ignoring, like, you know that something bad is coming. And so you have them, like, my favorite, the perfect example of this is Pretty Women. Pretty Women is one of the most intense scenes I've ever seen in a movie, let alone a movie musical. When he's the first time that he has the judge in the barber's chair, right? So he's there, and this guy who, you know, we know has killed his wife and stolen his daughter has finally come to Sweeney Todd to get a shave, and he just sits him down, and Mrs. Lovett, his kind of accomplice in all this, has before this instructed him to wait and like to enjoy the kind of, as the plan falls into place. So Sweeney is in this place of like, well, you know what? I got this guy here. Let me just play with him like a cat plays with his food for a little bit.
Mr. Todd.
At your service. An honor to receive your patronage, my lord.
You know me, sir.
Who in this wide world does not know the great Judge Turpin?
And so you just watch him give this man a shave, this man who he's clearly planning on killing, and you're like, every stroke is like, oh God, is this going to be it? Is this going to be it?
What more can man require?
More than love, sir.
More than love, sir.
What, sir?
Women.
Ah, yes, women.
Pretty women.
Ba 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 ba
Which is also not a new trope, right? The like the razor blade on the throat as you're shaving.
Oh,
like,
it's, yep.
Because the tiniest movement could end very, very badly.
But in this situation, you have a dude singing a song. Two dudes sing a beautiful duet. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
And the judge, played by Alan Rickman, which we'll talk about, is disabled in this, right? It's not just he's sitting there quietly waiting for a shave, but they're bonding, right? They're he thinks that he's making a friend and he's enjoying himself, and there's smiles, and there's like, if you didn't know any better,
oh my God,
you wouldn't think anything's going on. But obviously, given everything that's come before, you know that this guy basically like killed his wife, or so he thinks, and took his daughter, and he's like, you know,
it's
the villain in this man's life story.
It really, and Alan Rickman in this movie shows you how much can be done with little, because he's very subtle in this movie, but it really, you just know this judge as soon as you see Alan Rickman. And the judge is usually like cast in the stage plays, cast as like a decrepit old man, and it's very disgusting. Alan Rickman is incredibly handsome. You know, they give him like these long fingernails, but like he is he's still Alan Rickman. He's dashing as hell. I mean, this is, you know, dashing. Hans Gruber. He is wonderful in this part. It is such an amazing part for him because he doesn't play the villainy. Like he just allows him to be like certainly an imposing guy, but like a society man, and with just a sordid fucking past. And dude, that scene breaks my heart. And you know, and the other person who breaks my heart in this movie is Johnny Depp. I think this is one of his best roles. I really do.
I think so. And I mean, we were talking about Les Mis and the difficulty of bringing a stage actor, whether they sing, you know, aside or not, but somebody who has spent their entire career on film and not on stage. I was not for one moment in this film distracted by the fact that it was Johnny Depp.
Not one moment.
Right. In almost any other situation, you think, oh, it's Johnny Depp. Like, maybe just don't sing Johnny Depp. Like you're a great actor, but you're trying too hard. But it didn't feel like that in this. Like the music and the tone that he had and everything felt organic to the character and what Johnny Depp was bringing to the character. Like it all felt like it blended, that it could have been an original, that this wasn't a show before. Like this could have been an original, you know, creation.
And it brought him back to the Edward Scissorhands days when he was just, you know, he was an eye actor. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, and this is the kid from 21 Jump Street coming in and like giving you this virtuosic performance in Edward Scissorhands. That was like, what the hell, Charlie Chaplin, is this? And he does the same. It's like he builds upon it here. It's just very, you know, and I loved, I mean, again, you talk about improving upon the script. In my opinion, I've always felt that in the stage musical, Sweeney Todd talks entirely too much. He talks too much. We don't need to like what's scary about Sweeney is that Sweeney isn't, he, you know, Mrs. Right. Lovett talks. Sweeney is action. Sweeney is I do or I don't do. Sweeney is vengeance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you see this man who is just completely consumed with rage and vengeance has driven him mad, and he can't utter but one or two words. And the words that he can utter are so mumbled. Do you know what I mean? Like he's not there but for anybody but his own hatred.
Yeah. And it does it so effectively. Hold on. I just pieced this together. So I think that the fact that Sweeney doesn't like the theme of the film is revenge, right? And the consequences of revenge, and you know that whole like if you seek revenge, dig two graves. That
very
that
much
whole
so.
Kind of thing.
Very much so.
Very much so. It comes at, like the film starts knowing exactly where Sweeney is. It goes through the backstory in like a minute, and you understand. Okay, you see him young. You know what the judge did. You know that he's back to London for revenge. And it never lets off that. And everything that happens, every character, even when Sweeney's not involved, everything that happens is still circling Sweeney's revenge.
Everything.
The whole
every
movie.
Single thing.
Everything. And so, yeah. And so Johnny Depp, like, he doesn't have to talk that much. Because every time you see him, he's laser focused on what he's doing. And his focus becomes a point like they try and talk him off it. Like you need to chill a little bit. And he just doesn't know how to chill.
Yeah.
And the fact that the movie keeps that so on point the whole time is very impressive.
Yeah, it's totally. And I'm looking here and I'm seeing that it actually is based. So Sweeney Todd, I mean, obviously the story of Sweeney Todd, the legend of Sweeney Todd has been around, you know, for many, many years. Very much a Victorian era London.
Is it like a true
thing?
No,
I think actually it might be based on somebody. He came from Penny Dreadfuls in the early or the mid 1800s in London. I'm sure that it was only.
But he was a character before Sondheim.
He was definitely a character before Sondheim because there was a play that was written by Christopher Bond called Sweeney Todd. And that was in 1973. And then 1979, they come out with the musical and the book by Hugh Wheeler, who was the screenwriter who wrote it. And again, I think that it really is this, you know, the exposition is handled beautifully. And that's the one thing, you know, Sweeney Todd is just a really a brilliant, it teaches you so well, how, you know, I think for any writer, not just the movie, but the stage version as well. You know, Sondheim gives you the legend song, Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd, which is the ballad. And that sets up the mood. But that doesn't tell you anything mm-hmm. about the story. They tell you that Sweeney's a scary man. They tell you that it's like almost like you're hearing a ghost story, but they're not narrators. Nobody's narrating, right? When the characters come out and sing that song, it's very much just about setting up like you are here for a ghost story and we're going to scare the crap out of you. And then the story starts and there's no you learn a little bit about like all the exposition is told to you through characters who don't know. So like, you are learning as the characters learn, which is exactly what we want. And they hold off the full tale of Sweeney Todd, right, of his history, until about 20 minutes, like 20, 30 minutes into the story, once you've met Mrs. Lovett, right? So by the time we get there, we're waiting to hear what the hell happened to this guy. And so it fulfills that need beautifully when we learn it.
Yeah.
You know, and it really is this masterful kind of stroke of storytelling in the way that they do that. And the movie does the same thing. You open with no exposition, right? Because there's no Ballad of Sweeney Todd. And you just open with a sense of dread. You open with these guys on a boat. And then he steps off the boat and he goes to this pie shop. And Mrs. Lovett's talking to him about pies. And then she tells him this story about this barber who had a wife, you know. And you, again, just because of the musical motif, there was a barber and his wife that was used in the first scene. You automatically know that she's talking about him without her saying she's talking about him. And really just, I mean, I could talk for days about the brilliance of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, yeah. So right from the get-go, he's descending on London, yep. right? He's on the yep. boat. He meets this innocent kid. He's not mean. You almost sympathize with him from the start because he's not mean yeah. to this kid
yep.
who's just trying to get by. But he immediately says how he hates this town and he goes to the pie shop and he's focused on getting upstairs to his old apartment where he used to live. He quietly puts up with the noise around, yep. right? What was her
Mrs.
name?
Mrs. Lovett.
Mrs. Lovett. He sits and listens to Mrs. Lovett's whole, you know, pie song and all that and sits there. He doesn't have to really say anything before she realizes that that's who yep. it is. Reclaims, and she's kind of falling in love with him, and then they're figuring out how to get the judge and build the business and do all these things, and the whole time he's not actually mentally involved in really any of
all.
It he is only focused, even when he pretends to be doing something else, he is only focused on getting to the judge and killing
him.
Can I
just jump in and say the best example of that is probably my favorite Johnny Depp moment in the movie, and I think he was nominated for this, and I think that this moment probably is what got him the nomination, which was My Friends, when he's singing to the razor.
Mm-hmm.
These are my friends, see how they glisten, see this one shine, how he smiles in the light. My friend, my faithful friend.
What a beautiful scene that was.
And that is the kind of stuff, again, so if you've ever, see, now you got me going, and I'm about to go listen to all the Sondheim I have, because he is just genius at this stuff. So My Friends, who in their right mind would think of writing a song for your lead character when he sings to the goddamn razors that he's going to use to kill people, and he calls them his friends. And yet, in doing it, in the simple act of this man deeming these razors his friends, you understand how lonely this man is, you understand how lost this man is, and you understand how hell-bent on vengeance. And because the song is like a beautiful song, right? It's not like he's like angry.
It's heartfelt. It's a romance song. And the whole time contrasted by Mrs. Lovett standing behind him, kind of being like, "You're beautiful. I wish I could be with you."
It's heartbreaking.
You know, which is really, he should be singing this song to her or to somebody human.
And yet.
And instead he's singing it to what I assume represents his revenge.
The only thing he has left. He has nothing left.
The only thing he has left.
Oh, dude, I could. It's so I'm a high tenor. It would be very hard for me to play Sweeney Todd on an 8-show week, but let me tell you how much I wish I could play Sweeney Todd. I freaking love this character. I love this movie. It is just such.
I mean, I would pay money just to see you with that shock of white in your
hair. Dude, and that's not even in the show. That was like, that's a
Tim
Burton thing.
I mean, Brilliant addition.
Brilliant shock. Well, but you know what it does? It foreshadows, because the thing that is in the play is that, spoiler alert, when young Tobias comes up from the sewers to kill Sweeney, that his hair has gone white. That is it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the idea, and that's, again, you talk about a fucked up story. You know, this kid, so, you know, Mrs. Lovett adopts this young lad who is, you know, his former guardian was the first victim of Sweeney Todd's vengeance. This guy who's going to blackmail him to expose him, played brilliantly by Sacha Baron Cohen. I swear to God, because, like, again, tangent, but when Sacha Baron Cohen comes in, he does this amazing, like, this thing that's so much better than any other Pirelli that I've seen, where Pirelli comes in and he's like this very showboaty Italian, whatever. And then the scene where he drops it, and he's like, and he's just like some cockney asshole.
Mr. Todd.
Signor Pirelli.
Call me David. David Connor's the name when it's not professional. Alarm me £5 bet if you don't mind.
And it's just so grounded and real. You're like, oh shit, you're gonna die. You're gonna die. And it's just so, you're like, oh god damn it. But this kid who has had suspicions about Sweeney Todd the whole time, there's so many people in this show. I think one of the themes of the show as well is like unrequited love. People who like love people who just can't see that love. And Tobias the same way that Mrs. Lovett loves Todd, Tobias loves Mrs. Lovett. And he is always trying to protect her. He sings, you know, no one's gonna harm you. And then she,
which is heartbreaking to see her reaction to that, because it's such a warm moment. Like, oh my god, like maybe they'll bond and they'll leave Todd and go live. She'll raise him and they'll live together. And then you see her shuffle him off, the kid off, because she's so focused on Todd, even though, you know, Todd is only focused on the job. It's truly the dynamic of the relationships is so, and it's so crystal clear.
Just through song, you understand these things. Yeah. But point being, they lock him in, you know, they lock him in the basement where all these mutilated dead bodies are. And he's down there for hours. And by the time he comes up, you know, this poor kid who's already had, like, let's be real, Tobias has had a terrible life thus far, is like shocked white. So his hair turns white in the play, and they kept it for the movie. And it's such a nice,
I didn't even notice that. It's such
a nice nod, right? Because it foreshadows the trauma that Tobias is going to go through that Sweeney Todd went through.
Now is when we first meet Tobias, he's working for Sacha Baron Cohen for Pirelli. He's wearing a wig,
he is,
right? Because Pirelli makes a hair tonic and all that, but he's got this fake head of hair on. And the first time you see him take it off is when he feels comfortable with Mrs. Lovett.
Yep.
Downstairs in the meat shop. So, and then his hair turns white at the end. So is that
no, it, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think, I mean, thematic, because that's it, that his hair is the color of that wig, and that's the same in the play too. It's a brilliant little thing. It's like, you know, very much a foreshadowing. The other, you know, I love, you know, the use of hair as kind of a plot device and a connector of characters. You know, Joanna gets locked up in a mental hospital where they, you know, they cut people's hair to make wigs.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, there's so many references to shedding of who you are and becoming something else. And even Mrs. Lovett, you know, spoiler alert, is the person who, you know, I mean, she buries the fact that his wife, you like talk about burying the lead. She buries the fact that his wife is still alive, you know, yeah. And it really is the, you know, it's her doom, but like everybody is shedding a past and trying to make a future in this show. And that is the other, that's the other heartbreaking thing about it. Everybody's just trying to get somewhere better. And they have hope for that. And I love they kept this kind of sense. They changed a lot of the lines, but they kept the sense. There's a sense with Joanna and Anthony, you know, whenever you have these young lovers in musicals, it's like they meet for a day and then they're in love and they're going to get married. It's
oh, like that's, yeah. It was very Les Mis.
Very Les Mis to me. But this one has always had the sense of like, you know, these people aren't going to, like, this isn't going to work out. Like, this is like there's just a sense of foreboding because she is traumatized. She's been like, yeah. She spent her entire teenage years being like violated by this older man. And now she was just, you know, threatened. Her life was threatened by this guy who she doesn't know is her father. Like, she's had a traumatic freaking life.
Yeah.
You know, and so when she comes out and he's like, it's all going to be okay. And she's like, no, it won't. Like, it's not.
She's like, yeah, what do you think? We're just going to go away and live happily ever after? He's like, yeah, I hope so.
Like, it's like
his response wasn't like, oh, maybe you're right. Nope. Or, you know, oh, like you have to believe. It was just like this naive. Well, yeah.
It's
we're going to try.
It's so crazy, man. I can't speak enough good things about.
That's amazing.
Yeah, please, you know, let us know what you think, what your pick would be.
And some of the cast combinations, too, before we close this off.
Yeah.
Some of the cast combinations, I mean, speaking of Les Mis, the fact that Sacha Baron Cohen
and Helena Bonham Carter
are together again, which in Les Mis they play the Thénardiers. And then also just seeing Alan Rickman and Timothy
oh
Spall
my God.
Paired together in like peak Potter period too. This is like Snape and Wormtail.
It's
together.
Literally half the cast of...
Actually, when did Prisoner of Azkaban...
You would have had it
2004. So this was like 2 or 3 years after Prisoner of Azkaban, where Snape
like, Wormtail and Bellatrix
and Bellatrix have been in the like literally the exact same position.
Yeah,
you know, Helena Bonham Carter's got the same hair basically. it's beautiful.
No,
it's
it really is a beautiful and I again and even numbers like and this is my favorite thing, right? Because in a musical, you know, Sweeney Todd was never a dance musical. And I think that, you know, I think that we misunderestimate dance. And I'll go back to Cats and say, like, dance is a beautiful art form and should be used as often as possible. But I love a good musical that's a walk and talk. I love when you can show that musicals can stand without dance.
And the one time that they do use dance, it's not really dance, but dancing. Yeah. Is when Sweeney's dancing with Mrs. Lovett and he's got the giant cleaver in his hand.
He's got the cleaver. She's got the rolling pin.
He holds her hand with the knife in it and they're doing this dance, like swinging around each other and they're both holding on to things that they have.
And again, musically and foreshadowing Mrs. Lovett's death, right? Because it's the same dance and then he throws her into the furnace.
Correct.
Isn't that crazy?
Man,
that's so good. That's what I'm saying. Like, and this is, I think, what we want to take from this. If you write your musical smart, there's nothing that I swear to God, there's nothing that beats a smart musical. There's nothing that beats a musical. Like, yes, there's room for popcorn. There's room for fluff, but like you can do some amazing stuff.
Well, cause it's one more ethereal element, right? You have visual, you have dialogue, you have editing and you everything that makes a movie. And then music on, which is a whole other layer on top of it. And you just get this mountain of gloriousness.
Oh, it's so good, dude. I really do love it. And I suggest if you have not seen the movie version, please see the movie version. It is such a masterwork and everyone is great.
Very, very
Everyone's
good.
Everyone's great.
So for next week, we come back.
We'll do part two.
To do part two, which is the play.
The play.
The non-musical stage to screen adaptation. Yes. I'd say get at us so we can talk about it on the show, but We may have recorded.
Yeah, we may have recorded. But either way, I mean, tweet at us. Tweet at us with what your favorite stage to screen adaptations are, musical or movie or play. And we'll talk on the Twitters. And follow us on Twitter at Lil Justice Pod, LiljusTice Pod, and the same on Instagram now, LiljusTice Pod. And we will be in touch that way. So until the plays, my friend, next week.
Until next time.
Bye.
Little justice. Little justice. Little justice. Fuck yeah.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.